Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and our friend over at Fox Chicago, Dane Placco, had a good segment. Don't get to profile network affiliate newscast very much because they don't do very good work, generally speaking, but this is an exception.
Okay.
Dane Placco interviewing the three black Chicago police officers, all of whom have 20-plus years on the force, about all that is ongoing with police and civilian political authorities, both the mayor's office, prosecutors, the interaction with the public, the violence on the streets of Chicago, all of that, and then, of course, from the perspective of longtime officer and a black officer, three of them. And here's what they had to say about the climate. And before actually you hear from them, one thing that was nice about this interview is it got past the way the media normally reports these matters. It's police versus or police slash FOP versus the mayor's office, just like it's CPS or the mayor's office versus CTU. You know, it turns out that those relationships are a lot more complicated than just either this team or that team. These sort of handles that are used to synthesize complicated relationships and issues that arise from those relationships. But here are these three cops on the climate.
What's it like to be a Chicago police officer right now?
It's difficult. It puts you in a very compromising situation.
Challenging. You've got the political climate that really dictates how we police.
It's a very tough profession at this time.
Jeff, a patrol officer who comes from a cop family. Latasha, a beat cop who's worked districts all over the city. And Paul, a sergeant. Three African-American cops with more than 60 years experience shooting from the hip about policing in Chicago.
You have not been the police, you don't truly understand it.
The climate with the citizens, they're hostile. So a lot of times before you can even deal with whatever the request was that they call the police for, you've got to put the fire out because they're hostile toward the police in general, even though they call the police.
People do not respect authority.
So did some of them have to disguise their voice?
Yeah,
or their,
obviously.
Yeah. But not Latoya.
Yeah, and so so that's the one hand, the climate they're describing.
Pretty spot on.
It certainly runs consistent with what everything else we've heard, not to mention people's own experience in the city as residents. They also, though, provided some acknowledgement of the frustration in the black community with policing. They provided some rationalization for the anger.
I do understand the hostility. It just makes our jobs very difficult.
I believe that the black community has proper cause to mistrust the police based on the police history with blacks in this country. That being said, we can't lump every police officer in the same bunch. We have so many great police officers from all nationalities out here doing the job correctly.
Yeah, and that's a fair statement. You know, the thing about this is it's remarkable to me how it's always the relationship between the police and the citizens. And then you talk about the police and residents, and then you talk about the police and their relationship with political authorities, which you'll hear in a moment. What about the relationship between the residents and the political authorities?
Is there a relationship?
Well, I'd like to hear them sound off. I mean, that officer talked about the history of police and the black community. What about the history in Chicago of your civilian political authorities and the black community? Has that been a productive history? And I'm talking about that not just for black Chicagoans, but all Chicagoans. This is the most de facto segregated city, big city in America, arguably. And I think it's a pretty compelling argument. You went from Mayor Richard J. Daley warehousing poor blacks in these ghastly public housing projects to the scams that were run with minority contracting under Richard M. Daley, to the general lawlessness and essentially policy of containment with respect to the West and the South Sides. Don't let them get to the city center. Not to mention the quality of the schools that have been offered for the last 50 years, at least, through all those mayors I just mentioned, all the way up till present. What about that? And I guess, you know, there's been enough people that have been buffaloed into thinking that these people who spend all their time, these politicians and their functionaries too, CPS superintendents and whatnot, that spend all their time telling us how much they are for certain populations. I guess that's persuasive. It doesn't matter what the actual outcomes are for those said populations. I've said before on this show, the worst thing that you can hear from a politician is that they are taking an interest in your success. Then you know you're really in trouble. Because you know what their interest in your success almost always translates to is your dependency on them. Your dependency on them. That's when you really get in trouble. That's when you're really going to take a beating. Maybe not in the short term, but in the long term you are. So talking about these endemic problems in majority black neighborhoods on the West and South Sides, for example, no conversation about politicians. I mean, the police sort of bring it up in this interview they did with Placco, but I just find it generally absent when they, the executive of the city government, should be the first position analyzed, should be the first person held to account for what transpires or doesn't. And it's just not really a significant part of the conversation. They just skate on it. And this is why the Chicago Press Corps is just as responsible for Chicago being the worst governed big city in America as are the politicians, because they've run cover for all of these thugs and thieves and hacks for 50 years.
Yeah, they want access to them so they don't ask them hard questions.
So
if they do, they'll get on the list, the do not call list.
Yeah.
When they do their one-on-ones with people.
Yeah, their access is so illuminating. It's so important. It's such great work they do in exchange for that access, you know, spiking stories, elevating sacred cows in exchange for access. It's such a great deal for the city. They've really lived up to their responsibility as members of the Fourth Estate. Hardly. So back to the cops. On the politicians, you feel like they're behind you? Punchline.
You feel you have the support of City Hall?
Absolutely not.
And isolated.
When you feel like you don't have the support of the people that you're protecting, and you don't have the support of the people that you're working for and working with, it's a hard place to be.
They point to Mayor Lori Lightfoot's plans to change the department's foot pursuit policy following two recent police shootings that started with a chase.
It was not a wise idea for politicians to come out and say we're going to change it based on an incident. You jumped in there right away. You're saying that incident was wrong. You're some morale issue.
And they say it will be difficult to reverse years of police training.
You've been policing in high crime areas, and you work midnights, and you work in the dark, and you've been in alleys and vacant lots. You're going to do what you've been trained to do. You're not just going to stop and say, oh, the mayor just said we couldn't do
one of those.
Yeah.
Well, and then put it in perspective. What, almost 1,100 shootings since January? 8 have been police-related. 3 of those have been fatal. 2 happen to be foot pursuits. But that doesn't mean you go and change the whole system, because a lot of law enforcement not only here in Chicago, but, you know, in around the country, think that those, both of those shootings were justifiable.
Meanwhile, according to Dane Placco's report, police have been shot at 27 times so far this year, with four police officers being shot. Well, there's a stat you don't hear very much.
No.
And, of course, they are specific to Lightfoot, but not exclusive. They also have the message, a message for Kim Fox, if not by name.
Lack of prosecution on the state level. They understand that the police are hesitant about policing. You can smell the fear or the hesitancy of an officer and how they police, right? You take advantage of that. Of course, they feel like they're able to do whatever they can and get away with it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Officers also weighed in on the presence of racist cops or bad cops, and on the FOP. And this is in part where it gets a little bit more complicated and requires a little bit more of a textured understanding of the dynamics at play here within the department. And remember, we're talking about a department of 12,000 police officers. It's a lot of people. They're not monolithic in their outlook, their perspectives, their political leanings, and so forth. And so you may be surprised to hear this, but I don't think you should be.
I come from a community of African Americans who were policed by some of those racist cops. And I know what happened. I've been on the job for over 20 years, and I've had to stop some racist cops from doing racist things.
Yeah. I mean, has anybody ever disputed the fact that you have, in a 12,000-person organization, you're going to have some individuals who are bad at what they do, maybe maliciously bad at what they do? No. Does that mean we should defund the police?
They're going to need the police there. If you get rid of us, what will you have? Imagine a city without the police. If you think it's bad with the police, imagine it without the police.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty simple point, but a salient one. And then lastly, on the FOP.
They're not fans of the FOP.
I think they're awful. I think that how they respond to national crises and police shootings is almost like things you would say to your guys in the basement when you're having a couple of beers.
I didn't know that.
That's interesting.
Because they're FOP members.
Well, right, but it doesn't mean that you always appreciate how your union representation handles a particular issue, whether it's a contractual issue or a PR issue, like she mentioned in a police-involved shooting. And I'm not necessarily taking her side in terms of that perspective. I'm just saying it's a perspective that exists. And so to understand what's happening within the police department, you know, you need to get a better cross-section of viewpoint, and you need to address some of those things that some of those constructive criticisms, or just criticisms, frankly, that are raised. FOP needs to do it. Obviously, the mayor's office and Kim Fox's office need to do it. And I suspect, you know, perhaps with the exception of the FOP, very few will do it. And at least the FOP is compelled to talk to its members. Doesn't seem like anybody compels the political class in this city and state to talk to its residents.
No, they don't care about us.
It's constituents. I mean, they don't own their residents. It's their constituents. Not in any meaningful way. And, you know, again, to be fair to those ruling class politicians, their constituents seem to enjoy being treated like mushrooms. So why stop? Tim in Woodstock.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Amy.
Morning.
You know, I think you're right, Dan. I think the conversation is always deflected to the police. But, you know, the thing is that the politicians have created an environment, have helped create that environment where policemen have to deal with the worst of what people have to offer every day. And, you know, he talks about it's understandable that blacks are suspicious of police. But, you know, I think you could reverse that and say that a little bit of suspicion is justified these days. From policemen, based on having, you know, going into a neighborhood like this, it's just an unbelievable situation these guys have to, you know, walk into every day.
Thanks, Tim. John in Portage Park.
Yeah, good morning. I heard Charlie Kirk say that they don't want to defund all the police. They just want to defund the local police because they want to control the police at a federal level.
Yeah.
They won't. They want to defund.
That's wrong.
Go ahead.
That's wrong.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, I mean.
No, he said it, but
I understand that position. I think that position is laughable. There's no capacity for the federal government to do local policing across, you know, 50 states and hundreds of thousands of communities.
I thought it was interesting. That's all.
Absurd.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hey,
thanks
for the call, John.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always a struggle. I understand. The global ulterior motive, and somehow the Bilderberg Group is involved. And I'm not saying John is a conspiracy theorist, but here's what they're really doing. You know, these are people that have not demonstrated a particular competence on a range of matters, yet they're all collaborating to do something that is impossible to do. Focus on what they're not doing and what they are doing locally. Focus there. Maintain focus. Because when we get off on all of these, you know, sort of fantastical conspiracy theories with all these moving parts and all these players and shadowy organizations, and we connect dots that don't connect, we lose focus where it matters, on the ground where those police officers are and where Chicago residents are.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, continuing our conversation based on that interview Fox Chicago's Dane Placco did with three veteran Chicago police officers, who are all of whom were black, about the climate, about the mayor's office, about the Cook County prosecutor's office, about the FOP. Why is this so important? Well, it's pretty straightforward. If you don't have a safe city, you don't have a city. So if you want Chicago to go the way of Detroit and Baltimore, in addition to the terrible fiscal policies, continue to cheerlead defunding the police and de-prosecuting those apprehended by the police. Keep it up. There's a good comparison, frankly, to Chicago. Piece by Stephen Walters, who's a fellow at Johns Hopkins University's Institute for Applied Economics, on Baltimore. We talked about Baltimore the other week because their mayor, Brandon Scott, is a big de-prosecution guy and, frankly, reimagine guy, which is a euphemism for defund. Walters writes in his piece at City Journal, "A decade ago, Baltimoreans became lab rats in a fateful experiment. Their elected officials decided to treat the city's long-running crime problem with many fewer cops. In effect, this is a decade ago, Baltimore began to defund its police and engage in depolicing long before those terms gained popular currency. And it's been a spectacular failure. The annual homicide rate has nearly doubled from 31 per 100,000 residents to 56, which is 10 times the national rate. 93% of the homicide victims of known race over the period of the last decade, black. 3,000 Baltimoreans since 2011 have been murdered." And, you know, that's a city that now is not that much smaller than Chicago. I think it's like 2.2, 2.3 million people. Yeah. So now consider Chicago's numbers in light of Baltimore's. I mean, on a per capita basis, we're higher than Baltimore. Shootings and murders. And, of course, they have the same deal that we have. They've got Brandon Scott in the mayor's office. We have Lori Lightfoot. Although she is less pronounced about her perspective about this sort of defund, deprosecute culture. but she's going along with it. Brandon Scott is more outspoken, as is Marilyn Mosby. You remember her from Freddie Gray fame. Marilyn Mosby, who's the state's attorney for Baltimore. Mm-hmm. What's the upshot? I mean, there's a lot of detail here, but the upshot is today, the Baltimore Police Department patrols the city's 81 square miles with 18% fewer staff than a decade ago. Post-Ferguson, has become common to point to intuitively plausible but difficult to quantify reductions in the level of police effort to explain localized surges in crimes. The evidence for this claim, though tentative, is supportive. In Baltimore, the Ferguson effect, Heather McDonald, has intensified an established pattern of diminished policing resources contributing to rising bloodshed. And then add the deprosecution, where now Mosby is not going to prosecute what she terms, quote unquote, low-level drug and sex crimes. And this is how they spin it. So get ready for this, because this is how it will be spun here when we go the same way, which we are going. Mosby claims a 33% decline in 911 calls mentioning drugs and a 50% decline in calls mentioning sex work during her experiment and deprosecution proves that, quote, there is no public safety value in prosecuting these offenses. Anti-broken windows. Walters writes, to the contrary, with drug use and prostitution de facto legal, many residents have just stopped wasting their time calling the cops about dealers, junkies, hookers, or Johns on their block. How's that for quality of life? It's like trying to try call Chicago police if you live near Grand Park or you live near a park. Try calling Chicago police about drug use or prostitution or other quality of life concerns.
They don't care.
They don't have the resources.
They don't have the resources.
Well, they so
and by the time they get there, they're gone anyway.
Yeah. So what's so how does that impact your quality of life? How does that impact your enjoyment of the outdoors? Oh, I live next to this wonderful park. Can't go there. Can't send my kids there alone because it's overrun by homeless or junkies or what have you. There's no police response to it because there's no prosecution response to it.
We used to pick up needles before our kids' soccer games on the fields.
So how does that
by the lakefront there after you pass homeless people who are dropping a deuce in the street? And on the sidewalk.
So how does that,
It's disgusting. And then you play a team like League Forest and they have to come in and drive through that tunnel to get to the lakefront to see that. And then you get, the field is trashed.
Well, the kids from Lake Forest get to go back to Lake Forest.
I know. They're lucky. Yeah. But I'm saying that this is your welcoming to Chicago. It's horrifying.
I mean, you think because of the glistening condo buildings and corporate buildings
nice from afar.
In the loop that the city's just going to keep chugging along despite policies that are tearing at its very foundation. That's not what happened in Baltimore. I know Chicago's not Baltimore. Chicago's not Detroit. I get it.
Detroit easily.
It has a more diversified economy. It's more complicated. It is more complicated. There's no question. But, Greg and LaGrange, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. You know, this is just a disgusting, circular, whirling maelstrom of garbage every day that we hear. And I told the call screener that as soon as you brought up this piece from City Journal, it just took me right back to 2012 and the whole problem that the Minneapolis school system had when they decided we're not going to discipline the kids.
That's right. Yeah,
and what happened? And what happened to one of the teachers? One of the teachers who had an ideological bent that agreed with the policy ended up being severely injured by it, and they had to walk it back. And we had this little micro laboratory experiment on what happens when you don't enforce behavior and rules and imply law. And it was a dramatic failure. It failed everybody. It failed the teachers. It failed the administrators. And most importantly, it failed the kids, right? So what do? And and every day we hear the same thing. We institutionalize it. We take it out of the laboratory and we bring it out into the big world. And we try and apply this model in the big world. And then we expect different results, right? So now we're into the, what's the definition of insanity, applying the same policies and expecting different results. and there's no cost for it. And I think what happens now is that these cities have to go bust, like Detroit. And Amy, you mentioned Detroit. At least they declared bankruptcy and they're some way out. I don't know what their crime situation is there. But you know what? These places have not bottomed out yet. And all we're talking about is degrees. We want to talk about per capita, Baltimore, Chicago, L.A., San Francisco, Newark, New York City, that was just written about on Powerline, about their crime problem.
Yeah, it's shootings are up 54% in New York City.
Right. And when you want to assess blame for this, everybody's looking at, is it the pandemic? Is it this? Is it that? No. Look in the mirror. It's the citizens of this country that have basically tossed aside their values and went for a different avenue to approach their life down than raising families, building strong nuclear families, building strong communities. And all of it is what leads to this complete, and let's call it what it is, disaster.
Thanks, Greg.
Disaster.
Thank you, Greg. And the whole we're going to end the schools to prison pipeline propaganda associated with the with non-disciplinary action against students who even are violent. Edina, Minnesota, was sort of ground zero for that, as Greg was referencing, and that's a good one. That's another aspect to this. So was Parkland. Remember Parkland? The shooter was somebody who was on their radar.
Oh, yeah, many times.
And the superintendent of that school district, is a Chicago guy who was trained in end the school-to-prison pipeline. And so when, you know, he brings a backpack full of ammo to school, you know, that says there's somebody who's crying out for help. That's the business of a school counselor. Not something to notify law enforcement about. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple. It's what that one Chicago police officer said in the Dane Placco interview.
People do not respect authority.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the bottom line.
At least people committing crimes. And the only authority that we're taught to respect is as it pertains to the reductions in our freedom. And I'm not talking about prosecutions, obviously. I'm talking about things like the pandemic policies. We have the great combination here of a small percentage of Chicago residents who are, you know, Clockwork Orange street thugs, and a big percentage of Chicagoans who are automatons. Whatever is repeated enough becomes what they will do and will think. Thus, you see all the mask wearing outside. Despite everything we know. Dude, despite even things that have been said now about mask wearing outside. Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Nope.
There is only government edicts where a brain used to be for a majority of the city. And then the other small percentage of the city is in on the joke. They're predators. And they just understand because we've communicated quite clearly. You got the run of the place. Do what you want. That's how it is. And that's how it's going to be. But that doesn't mean that they're not heroic actions taken by police officers. And I wanted to mention a couple of them and take your calls if you have others. Particularly, I know we have a lot of cops who listen to the show. So
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
If you want to elevate the profile of a colleague who did something heroic on the job, sure. Most recently, of course, was this Times Square shooting over the weekend. I know there's been a suspect who's been named.
Yeah.
I don't think he's in custody yet.
He was meant to shoot his brother, but he shot innocent bystanders.
Yeah, including a 4-year-old girl.
Oh, I know.
And this New York Police Department cop named Alyssa Vogel, you've probably seen the pictures or video. She picked up the girl and rushed her away from where the shooting was occurring.
Yeah, she tied a tourniquet
to protect
first.
Her.
Yeah, she tied it. You can see from her body camera was released yesterday. She tied a tourniquet. Said the first time she's ever had to do that in her career. And then instinct just kicked in and she rushed her to an ambulance and rode with her to the hospital and said that, you know, the magnitude of what happened flushed upon her when she was at the hospital and thought, oh my gosh, this poor mom and these poor, they're just walking down the streets of New York City in Times Square. Times Square.
Yeah, she's a mom to a six-month-old boy herself, and she said her motherly instinct just kicked in terms of rescuing that girl, protecting that girl. That's one example. That's gotten a little bit more profile. Anybody know the name Damon Gutzweiler?
I do not.
Yeah, I didn't either, but thanks to Lee Habib, our friend, writing over at Newsweek, piece, cop's name you don't know but should. 2 weeks after Chauvin took the life of an arrest suspect in Minneapolis, Sergeant Damon Gutzweiler of the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office in California responded to a report of a suspicious van. The 911 caller reported seeing guns and bomb-making devices inside the vehicle. When Gutzweiler and fellow deputies arrived at the scene, they saw the van leave, and they did what they were trained to do. They followed it. As the vehicle pulled into a driveway of a home in the mountain town of Ben Lomond, the officers were ambushed with gunfire and IEDs. Two were shot in the crossfire and recovered. Gutzweiler, a 14-year veteran, wasn't as fortunate, pronounced dead at a nearby hospital not long after he was shot. He was 38 years old. He had a wife. He had a 2-year-old son named Carter. And his wife was pregnant with the family's second child. So, you know, I'm all for reporting on police-involved shootings, particularly those that are controversial. I'm all for transparency and accountability for every public institution, including police. But it is odd, and it is noteworthy, the diligence with which the press corps approaches not reporting on instances where police have acted heroically, even where police have acted heroically and sacrificed their lives in so doing, like Damon Gutzweiler in Santa Cruz County. So just want to make sure we profile those stories, too. We don't fall into the trap of the rest of the media, as I described. Verlon on the South Side.
In the words of Hillary Clinton, what difference does it make? Listen, you own that property. You pay those taxes. You stop being a coward and take your own corners back. If the politicians are going to defund the police, you have the right to carry guns now. If you're not going to defend your property, you can't expect these politicians to. I bet you don't see the gangs and people standing on the corner and selling drugs in Oak Lawn or Evergreen or some of these suburbs. Yeah, they'll fight for their property. So stop being cowards and take care of your own business and take care of your own property. That's what I say.
All right. Thanks, Verlon. Ed in Oak Brook, speaking of the suburbs.
Yeah, you know what, Dan? You're describing a mess. It seems like every morning that's all we're reporting. But the truth of the matter is the cops are under siege, even in the burbs, because let's say the jerks are even challenging the cops, and they want them to be aggressive with them and hit them and be rough with them so then they could sue them under this great plan by this great governor that makes it that these idiots, jerks, can actually sue the police. So what do you think the police are going to do? They're going to walk. They ain't going to help anybody. They're just going to take it, smile, and walk away. So it's going to get a lot worse. Have a nice day.
Thanks for the call, Ed.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, MIT researchers. In a study entitled Viral Visualizations, How Coronavirus Skeptics Use Orthodox Data Practices to Promote Unorthodox Science Online. Belying the density of the title of that study, here's what they looked at. They infiltrated, quote unquote, a COVID skeptics community a few months ago. Found that these MIT researchers found that skeptics place a high premium on data analysis and empiricism. Quote, most fundamentally, the groups we studied believe that science is a process, not an institution, which is what science is. I'm quoting from the study. Indeed, anti-maskers often reveal themselves to be more sophisticated in their understanding of how scientific knowledge is socially constructed than their ideological adversaries who espouse naive realism about the quote-unquote objective truth of public health data. In other words, anti-maskers value unmediated access to information and privilege personal research and direct reading over quote-unquote expert interpretations. Its members value individual initiative and ingenuity, trusting scientific analysis only insofar as they can replicate it themselves by accessing and manipulating the data firsthand. They are highly reflexive about the inherently biased nature of any analysis and resent what they view as the arrogant self-righteousness of scientific elites. Many of the users believe that the most important metrics are missing from government-released data. The COVID skeptics, as they're called, more sophisticated in their understanding of how scientific knowledge is socially constructed. Science is a process, not an institution. Oh, those COVID skeptics, those COVID truthers, those anti-vaxxers. No, no, just pro-science. Just pro-science. And so you'll forgive me, I'll speak for myself, Amy can speak for herself, when we rinse and repeat what we understand from the science to date on restrictions like mask wearing, like social distancing, MIT study out just the other week that I referenced on this show.
Doesn't matter if you're 6 feet or 60 feet apart.
About the folly of it.
Yeah.
It's just that these are inventions. And at best, they are open for serious critical debate. But instead, we get the at worst, which is they're just accepted because they have been repeated enough times by people with credentials who are amplified on television. And so they become the unmitigated, unquestioned truth. Well, they're not. The statements aren't. Whether they're coming from a TV doctor like Fauci or a TV politician like Lightfoot. And so the TV doctor Fauci was at it again this weekend on the topic of masks.
I think so, and I think you're going to probably be seeing that as we go along and as more people get vaccinated. The CDC will be almost in real time, George, updating their recommendations and their guidelines. But yes, we do need to start being more liberal as we get more people vaccinated. As you get more people vaccinated, the number of cases per day will absolutely go down. We're averaging about 43,000 a day. We've got to get it much, much lower than that. When that gets lower, the risk of any infection, indoor or outdoor, diminishes dramatically.
And that was his response to, you know, eventually are we going to ease up on mask wearing indoors?
Hello. Much, much lower. How low?
I don't know.
What's the number?
What's the threshold?
Yeah. So out of an abundance of caution, maybe we should never stop wearing masks again.
He said it could be seasonal. You know, with flu numbers, flu cases go up in the wintertime, people might want to wear their masks. And
why don't we just treat masks like Christmas decorations?
Oh.
It can be seasonal or they can be all year. Because I just don't feel like taking them up or taking them down, because then I just have to turn around and put them up again.
Exactly.
Why put them up in, around Thanksgiving when I'm just going to have to put them back up around Thanksgiving next year? So I'll just, same thing
just
with masks.
Them. Okay.
Rather than just for flu season, just wear your mask all year round.
But people are doing that. I mean, you had the president of the United States come out and say, folks, you don't need to wear a mask outside. And people are still in Chicago wearing masks outside. God bless the governor of Utah. He's not allowing masks in schools next fall. He said, we're done with this. There's no masks anywhere in stores and they're big supermarkets, big box stores, no masks, unless you choose to wear one. And most people are not wearing one. But listen to this child. This is a 7-year-old. And it's hard to watch as a parent and to hear it too, because she has been wearing a mask since September to school. The mask is so tight, Dan, you could see her ears folding forwards. And she's miserable. She doesn't want to get on the school bus. Her mom's trying to convince her to go to school, but the mask, she cannot breathe.
Yeah. I can't breathe in this mask.
it's just child abuse, and it's a lot of pain that parents have to go through on a daily basis to get their kids to go to school wearing this contraption on their face, which is literally suffocating some people.
Might be time to go to a different school.
Well, what's private schools in the area? I know I have a really good friend who's trying to find a private school that does not require masks.
Yeah. No, I know. It's, you know.
She homeschooled him this year, and she wants him to back.
And even in private schools, as we've discussed, you're going to have to push on some of the private schools that you're paying for. Parents are going to have to get together in the same way they need to get together with government schools and press on the decision makers there to follow the science and data, to stop appealing and accommodating the lowest common denominator of the fear-addled. The whole problem here is even people who know better are still basing policy on those who are living for the worst case scenario rather than the most likely scenario.
Right. There's an inherent risk every time you leave your house but something's going to happen.
Why? If you're the head of an institution and you know better, and particularly with schools, we know a lot now, sort of like with masks and outdoor transmission. We know a lot now. Why would you continue to perpetuate something you know to be untrue to accommodate the lowest common denominator of understanding with respect to the virus? This is a fundamental problem that is occurring at present. It's one thing when it was, you know, the understanding wasn't what it is now. It's another thing as we're reopening, as some states have reopened a long time ago, wide open. Some states never closed their schools. Some countries never closed their schools. We know all about this. And yet still, and it also speaks to something that's problematic in American culture, is accommodating the lowest common denominator of understanding rather than setting the bar a little bit higher and saying, this is how we do it here. And if you don't like how we do it here, then you don't have to come here as a private institution.
Well, then people are going to have to move out of the state of Illinois.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. I've got some good news. When you're allowed to travel across the pond to merry old England, as of May 17th.
Can we hug?
Yeah, hugs are back.
Oh, thank you. I heard Boris Johnson yesterday say that. Like,
now.
Oh, my.
Now.
They're governing your hugs?
Now, they should be done with care. No reckless hugging.
What's defined as reckless hugging?
Done with care.
When I sneak up on you, give you a bear hug from the back.
I don't know. I don't know that Boris has put out a laminated card on how to hug yet, but you can expect that they will be put out by the National Institute for Health there, as well as here, and in particularly in certain states. I'm sure the public health professionals, Awardi and Ezeke here, are busily working up their PowerPoint on how to properly hug when we're allowed to hug again here. I hope people weren't recklessly hugging on Mother's Day.
Oh, I hope not.
No.
I mean,
you know, because there's a South African variant you got to worry about
right.
when you hug.
Oh, and there's an Elk Grove variant I heard is very contagious.
Ray in Barrington.
Good morning. I think you bring up Fauci early in the morning just to get everybody's blood pressure
exactly.
up. I did think a reckless hug is what Biden used to do when he approached women from the back.
There you go.
His handlers take care of that now. But I think Fauci's biggest example of not following the science was the same week that vaccines were approved, England decided to focus on one shot. But they didn't waste a month.
Yep, yeah. They did it right.
First shot
to go
first.
On one shot.
Right.
Instead of two, they got everybody taken care of. Even that nut job doc, Zeke Emanuel, agrees that England did it right. Fauci did it wrong. Since then, England did 80% better than us. Since then, we've averaged 1,000 deaths a day. So I figure we got 800 deaths a day on Fauci's doorstep.
Thanks for the call, Ray. Yeah, the first, we've talked about it, but perhaps not enough, but the first shot, first philosophy was the right play. And a number of people argued that from the outset.
Oh, but the teachers union across, the American Federation of Teachers, they wanted both shots before they went back to school. Do you know there's still 10% of our population that is still not back, or the 10% of school kids are still not back in school, have not seen their classroom since last March. And that's acceptable?
Well, Tony Fauci, St. Fauci, is driving some people out of science and into more honorable careers, like Hannah Sanford.
Who's that?
Hannah Sanford formerly was employed at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases under Tony Fauci. Okay. She
is this one of those, where is she now?
She was also, most recently, had a position at a pharmaceutical firm developing anthrax vaccines. Before that, she was a research assistant at Harvard Medical School studying formulas to fight HIV and AIDS. But now, because of what science has become, thanks to political hacks like St. Fauci, she is doing, as I said, something more honorable.
She do is, tell. What she is she doing?
Using the OnlyFans platform. I'm sure you're familiar with it. Mm-hmm. To paint abstract visualizations of her own orgasms.
Gross. But yet I wonder what it looks like.
She often, I'm sure you do, she often paints in the nude or in sexy lingerie. I really focus on feeling, on the feeling I had in my body and channel it through me out into the canvas. It's a creative release. I bet it is. The orgasm art sells for $500 a pop, so she's given herself a raise by leaving Fauci's stewardship and becoming an artist.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I'm not saying that she wasn't a good scientist. I don't know. I just know what she's doing now. I wonder if Tony Fauci would give her a letter of reference.
Oh.
Maybe something for Tony Fauci.
Oh.
Yeah. I'd like to see what her orgasm art would.
Well, do we have a picture in that article?
What do you mean a picture? Yeah.
Let me see.
Yeah. I'll
decide if this is.
This is theater of the mind. This is radio. Oh. Yeah. I mean, unless you want to do this.
Unless you're looking in our Matrix Home Solutions.
Yeah. You want to put that on the stream there?
Oh. Wow. Oh. Okay.
What do you make? This is sort of a Rorschach. What do you make of that? What do you make of that?
It's interesting.
Is that?
It's better than I thought it was going to be.
It's $500 a pop.
It's a little pricey, but okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Her outfit's not bad.
This one is called Orgasm Thinking of Fauci.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity this afternoon at 2 on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, so, the mask wearing, you see it in Chicago, mainly Chicago outside. I see it much less in the suburbs, but I see some of it.
It's not as bad, though. I feel freer out in the burbs. Like, I'll go to Brandt's and walk around with my sister in her neighborhood and just, you can see people's faces, and it's just a breath of fresh air.
But violating mask policy, private institutions, public colleges, but essentially they're making their own disciplinary policy with respect to the COVID restrictions they impose. It could go down like this, as you have so many schools mandating you be vaccinated before returning to campus.
Oh, yeah.
And even after being vaccinated, there's still mask policy in force, as a couple of students at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst found. University of Massachusetts Amherst, keep in mind, like U of I, public land-grant university. Taxpayers have a say, at least theoretically.
There was a photo sent to the administration of these girls outside, off campus, on a Saturday. This is why they've lost a whole semester of their schooling.
Tewksbury parents Kristen and Scott are speaking out on behalf of their daughter. She, along with two of her friends, shown here in this photo, are freshmen at UMass Amherst. And it's this picture that was posted on social media, and then someone handed it over to the university, that has landed them in serious trouble.
She and two others attended a gathering off campus and were immediately removed from housing and suspended.
It's heartbreaking.
Teresa and RJ's daughter was also suspended. What also infuriates these parents was this video of the UMass Amherst hockey team celebrating their national championship on campus. Some students, including some of the players, could be seen not wearing masks.
I just want the university administration to be equitable and fair.
Since their suspension, the students have been studying remotely at their homes. But just last week, they were cut off from their virtual learning. They weren't allowed to take their finals, so this entire semester was a total loss, both academically and financially.
So that negates this whole semester, $16,000 of money, and they have to reapply for next semester.
UMass Amherst released a statement saying students received a number of public health messages this semester that emphasized the importance of following public health protocols and the consequences for not complying. And those messages were also shared on UMass social media channels.
One little thing happens and you're out. Like, not even like a, here, you know, don't do it again. Here's some probation.
So for this to happen, it's been devastating.
$16,000. That's in-state tuition, to be sure. That's not out-of-state
right,
for UMass
Amherst. But 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. It was three girls. They looked like they had on, it was St. Patrick's Day. It was off campus. It's no one's gosh darn business what they're doing when they're not in school, off campus, at a party. It looked like a St. Outdoors. They weren't even indoors. They were outdoors, people, and they took a picture together.
What do you think of the parents?
Without masks on.
What do you think of the parents' response?
That they should have gotten a warning first? That was one. I know that they've lawyered up. But they should be fighting back more. I mean,
What do you think of the parents' response? One is there should be, escalatory discipline, shouldn't be zero tolerance, and the appeal to equity, because some members of the hockey team and students got away with not wearing masks on campus when they were celebrating. So in the interest of equity, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636 DA, turnkey.pro text line. Nobody has an answer. It's just file a lawsuit. Let the lawyers handle it. There's thinking that is displayed by the response that was provided. No. All right, well, I'm tired of doing the thinking for everybody. Well, so
I just want the university administration to be...
Sorry. Make whatever comments you want. Joe in Naperville.
I pray to God if somebody follows these administrators to the end of the earth and gets a picture of them without their masks on and demand their immediate resignation.
That's an idea. I would just pull my kid out of that school and say you're going to a different school that has more reasonable leaders and then sue and get my money back. Because that is a whole wasted year. And $16,000.
Semester.
A semester. Yeah, but their whole year's gone. Well, I don't know if the credits, they kicked them out of, you guys, they kicked them out of their dorms and made them go home and then shut them off from inline, from e-learning.
Yeah, but that was for a semester. And then they, as you heard him say, they have to reapply to be allowed back in the fall.
Never submit my child to that.
Yeah, it's another great story about the state of higher education and whether or not you want to pay tens of thousands of dollars a year
for unreasonable people who don't think
to send your child to that experience.
But do you understand, though, it's none of their business. It was not on a campus event. You can easily grab one of those administrators at UMass Amherst who are at a restaurant or getting, walking down the street without a mask.
Yes, it's none of their business. Yes, it's hypocrisy. Yes, it is a draconian punishment, and it's, zero tolerance, zero thinking. All these zero tolerance policies are akin to the, using your index finger and thumb as a gun and being drummed out of school that we've seen at the K-12 level. So, yes, it's all those things, but there's something else. There's something missing from that response, and it's not litigation. although that's fine if that's what it takes to get your money back. Something missing from that.
What?
Mike on the north side.
Thanks for taking my call. Good morning. The last segment you were talking about Saint Fauci. I know you were being facetious, because if Fauci's a saint, then I'm an exercise guru and a dietitian. The only two places I would leave Illinois for, you don't need the COVID vaccine. That's Branson, Missouri, and the Wisconsin Dells. I'm not getting the vaccine. I will never get the vaccine. When I leave the house, I have a St. Jude medal on and a scapular of Our Lady of Mount Carmel. Herd immunity is mine, saith the Lord. Forget this fake science.
Catholics don't get COVID, right? Yeah.
Herd immunity is mine, saith the Lord. I like that. Thanks, that's Mike. Good. It's pretty good.
All right. Tell us what we're missing, please.
No.
No, come on.
Hey, whatever. You'll figure it out when your kid loses a semester or a year of school because some, lives of others snitch on campus sends a picture of them to the administration for, adjudication and re-education and puts them in the doom chamber.
You will not leave the house again. You must obey.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is 60 Seconds of Sanity with Dan Proft. The timer starts now.
Maryland Governor Larry Hogan says the GOP is a circular firing squad. Illinois Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger compares it to the Titanic. Those are awfully pessimistic characterizations of a party well-positioned to regain both chambers of Congress in 2022, based on the census-driven redistribution of seats to red states and the Biden administration's ideological overreaches in all states. In fact, the Hogan and Kinzinger hysterics are performative. Having turned on the majority of the party to which they affiliate, they seek refuge in the status conferred by leftist cable news hosts. The combination of the two want us to believe the future of the GOP rises or falls based on who is number three in the House GOP caucus. Absurd. By whining about Trump loyalty tests that don't exist, these never-Trump Republicans are unwittingly or wittingly working to stifle substantive questions about the 2020 election and the administration of future elections in the same way the left seeks to silence debate on all issues. Don't believe their hype. Never stop asking questions. And now,
60 seconds. Total madness. This is 60 Seconds of Crazy with Amy J.
I thought it was 30 seconds of crazy.
Yeah, you guys.
I thought it was 30 seconds.
Equity.
Oh, now it's 60 seconds?
We can throw in some more feral cat noises if you run out of material.
Yeah. Thank you. But just so you know, this didn't take long for somebody to find the president of UMass. His name is Marty Meehan. And look at here, Dan. He's on the streets taking a picture without a mask on. I think he should be removed from office immediately.
At least suspended for a semester without
pay. Suspended was for a semester, right, without pay. And then he'll have to reapply for his job next year. And also no letters of recommendation for him if he chooses to move on to a different university. They should treat him as they're treating those three girls. And also, we're learning that the person who snitched sent this picture of three girls at an off-campus party outside taking a picture without a mask. Somebody sent it to the UMass Daily newspaper. That's how it got started. So some snitch out there is probably patting themselves on the back like, I did well. I did my civic duty today. Shame on him. So what, Dan, would you do if those your kids were one of these three in the picture here?
Well, by the way,
what are we missing?
That was not crazy. That was perfectly grounded.
Darn it.
When we do 60 seconds of crazy, we want unhinged irrationality.
Okay. Well, I just thought of something.
Okay.
You know how I've been calling places that have their flags still at half-staff?
Yes, that's a good example.
Okay. So there's this mortgage. I don't know if I should call the bank out, but I've called them three times now, and they still have not raised their flag. It's a business on Dundee. In between Arlington Heights Road and Buffalo Grove Road. What? No, I'm not cuckoo. It's in Wheeling, and they're pissing me off because they're not raising the flag. They keep telling me, oh, yeah, I'll tell my supervisor. I said, now, and then the next time I called, I said, now I want to talk to your supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't let me talk to them.
Are you going to be presenting at a future board meeting? What's the name of the business? Are you going to tell us the name of the
Hoyne
business?
Hoyne Loans, Hoyne Mortgage Loan.
Uh-oh.
What? Well, you told
Now you walked right into my trap.
It's on Dundee Road, and their flag is at half staff, and they should raise it. Okay?
Half staff because you're...
Because Pritzker lowered it a year ago because of COVID cases.
And the flag is supposed to be at half staff forever until...
No, until April 17th, it was supposed to be raised, and a lot of businesses didn't get the memo.
I don't think it should be raised until we can safely hug again.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The decline of American manners. That is the topic of a piece in National Review by Brad Miner, who's the author of the new book, the new edition to his book, The Complete Gentleman, The Modern Man's Guide to Chivalry, which releases today, as a matter of fact.
I thought chivalry was dead.
I thought the idea of a man was dead. Remember Jeffrey Ross's quip about Caitlyn Jenner? Yep. Bruce Jenner got out just in time. Brad Miner, former literary editor of National Review, currently the editor of The Catholic Thing, senior fellow of the Faith and Reason Institute, and as I said, the book, The Complete, that's C-O-M-P-L-E-A-T, like quintessential, Gentleman, The Modern Man's Guide to Chivalry. Brad, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be with you.
Your piece in National Review, I appreciate the reference to the Sumner Preston affair. It was Preston, right?
Yeah.
Our relations with one another ebb and flow, you write. Nobody is being caned on the Senate floor these days, at least. But today, politics is far likelier to make us meaner to each other. Maybe a good caning or two on the Senate floor would help.
Well, you know, a number of people have said that to me. I'm not sure it would, actually. And besides, we do a different kind of caning now. You know, it's the lashing with the tongue. And there is so much incivility that we clearly have fallen into a situation in which the one that the founders feared most, which was the country being divided into factions, they tried to create, as I say, also in that piece and in the book, an American republic as the gentleman writ large. Now, when I say gentleman, it applies to ladies as well, a particular kind of restraint and balance that ought to govern one's life, they believed should be the structure of the polity under which we live. And so those checks and balances, the separation of powers, the creation even of the Electoral College was a way to try and keep us together. Whatever our differences would be, the notion of the Constitution especially was that we would go along together. And in another book that I wrote a few years back called Smear Tactics, which was subtitled The Liberal Campaign to Defame America, I showed the party platforms of the Democrats and the Republicans from 1956 and 1960. And honestly, it reminded me of the old claim that there's no difference between the two parties. And people thought that was a bad thing. Well, frankly, it was a good thing because you see in those two platforms essentially the same program of both parties. Little difference on farm policy and foreign policy. But nonetheless, you could see how we were moving along together on the same line. So the point is, whether you're an individual living your life or whether you're someone trying to build, you know, the American Republic in a new way, to lose sight of that sense of unity that derives from these transcendental points of view that formed the idea of the gentleman over from the time of chivalry in the Middle Ages all the way up through certainly the First World War. We've lost that, and it's a shame.
Well, but chivalry is one of those patriarchal institutions that needs to be deconstructed. That's puritanical. It's repressed. It's prudish. It's male-oriented. And so the whole idea of chivalry casts women in these limited gender role, and that's why that needs to be blown up with other patriarchal institutions.
Well, so they say. Of course, none of that's true. But in any case, I start out the book talking about Titanic, the sinking of the Titanic, and the women and children first principle that was the only thing that, you know, saved anybody's lives. It was a terrible disaster. No one would probably say at this point, we shouldn't put children first. We all instinctively want to do that. Mm-hmm. Many women would object to the idea that they're assumed to be the weaker sex. And in many cases, women are not the weaker sex anymore. The strongest woman, athlete or soldier, is much stronger than the weakest man. That will always be the case. Women are getting increased roles. But that doesn't change the fact that you and I, Dan, are XY, and Amy is XX.
Right.
And there are implications for that that simply it's ridiculous to deny.
Well, right, and but that is being denied. And by the way, the story out today or yesterday about the Army Combat Fitness Readiness Test, 44% of female enlistees failed, 7% of men did. Is that because of gender inequity? No, obviously not. Is that because of systemic misogyny in the U.S. Army? Hardly. It's because of the realities of bone density and muscle mass and so on and so forth. But I think it's hard to be chivalrous. Thus, it's hard to be a gentleman and a gentle lady when everybody is living their truth. And there is no transcendental understanding of our common humanity that you're describing. And so thus it's off the rails.
Well, it's only hard if you refuse to take up the challenge. This book is a history as much as it is any sort of self-help book. It traces the development of these ideas from the Middle Ages and even before,
mm-hmm.
And takes it right up to our present time, tries to redefine the idea for the 21st century. Changes have come, and particularly the differences between men and women are simply not the same, or the assumptions about them are not the same as they always were. And now I'm talking about roles, not about that fundamental genetic difference, which is what you were just talking about with regard to the Army physical fitness test. We just have to accept that. We cannot, particularly in the military, I divide the book up into a number of different chapters, but there were three that sort of go to the archetypes, I think, are a part of the complete gentleman's character, and those are the warrior, the lover, and the monk. And in both the warrior and the lover, I spend a great deal of time on this question of the difference between the sexes and what it has to mean and what it doesn't have to mean. And certainly we're not putting the feminist genie back in the bottle. I don't think we should want to do that. But the point is, when it comes down to the mission of the military, we cannot make sacrifices for politically correct reasons.
Right. And as a woman, I agree. But I want to...
Thank you, Amy.
Yeah, but when you talk about the decline of American manners, a lot of liberal Democrats will insist that President Trump is to blame for the incivility. Is that a fair assessment?
No, it's not a fair assessment. He plays a role in it. And I think that, in fact, if he had read my book, he'd still be president.
Yeah.
You know, there's just a sense in which I think, I say that restraint is the great lost quality of American life. I tell the story of going to a blind date at some friend's apartment, a man and a woman, who wanted me to meet a young woman. And so I'm there after work wearing a suit and tie, and this woman shows up an hour late. She comes in a tracksuit. She sits down across from me, demanding that they give her a scotch on the rocks, and she says to me, "You won't believe what my therapist just told me." Now, this is the first time I've met this
great
woman.
First
and I'm
impression.
Thinking,
yeah.
Well, what'd she
you
say?
Know, honestly, A, I don't want to know what your therapist told
well,
you, and
know.
B, I want to get out of here as fast as I can.
I saw that episode of The Sopranos. I didn't know you dated one of the... That's no, yeah, okay, all right, yeah, yeah, and obviously that goes both directions because in
of course
dates that I've gone on, which are usually one and done, I'm the woman in the tracksuit, but not a woman. same sort of boorishness, it also speaks to this the whole idea of the modern man's guide to chivalry, and as you say, gentle men and gentle ladies. But the whole idea of gender distinctions is under attack. So there is a segment of the population. It's small, but it has oversized influence. Wants to eliminate this, what they describe as a social construct altogether.
I know that's what they want to do, and it will not succeed. They will make inroads. There will be battles won by that side. Heaven knows. There have been a lot of battles won by their side. I mean, I think particularly of, well, we're going to see something interesting this summer when the Olympics happen, assuming that they do happen in Tokyo. Women who are track athletes and other athletes in sports, but especially in track and field, they are now under threat by men who say they're women, who've come through puberty and have had that tremendous boost of testosterone and all the other changes that happen. And then sometime in their 20s, they say, you know what, I'm a woman. And perhaps they were a second-rate male athlete, but with all that testosterone and the development through puberty, they have an advantage that is truly unfair. And it comes against women who have fought, you know, since the 1960s to get equal treatment in sport. It wasn't until the London Olympics that all the events that men do are now also done by women. They're not going to go down quietly.
Yeah.
There's already a fight underway. And so when these things come to a head in very specific situations, a lot of women who would be liberal, feminist, and inclined to want to give a nod to transgender, male to female transgenders, are not going to do it in this context. They're just not going to do it.
Well, here's the thing about that. You know, you quote Chesterton in your piece, A National Review, and that calls to mind my favorite observation from Chesterton, which is those who have given in to unreason are ready for unkindness. And that's where we are as a culture. Mm-hmm. And so, and I've heard this from Ryan Anderson as well, but we're not seeing it. We're not seeing, you know, as the advance continues of, for example, male track athletes dominating women's track events, that there's a recognition and that this opposition is going to form and it is going to push back. It's happening in sort of one-off contexts, but it's not happening writ large. And the trans side is on the march. So here's the thing. With the state of the family and the incidence of single parenthood across all demographics, combined with the exodus from faith communities of most Americans, for the first time, less than half of Americans affiliate with a church or synagogue, place of worship.
Yep.
So where does this backbone come from? Where does this understanding of what's good and true come from that's going to rally people to these fights? I'm not saying it, to be honest.
Well, I think it comes from the hearts and minds of individual men and women. I've never really met a woman, I don't think, who wants, if she's interested in marriage in any case, who wants a weak man.
Right.
I mean, it's just not what you want. And I most men I know don't want a woman who's a pushover whom they can dominate. We're beyond that, I hope. But around the country, state legislatures are taking action about men, transgender, the male to female transgenders competing against girls and women in sports. Laws are being passed in certain states. It's to some extent, it tracks almost like the abortion question, where, you know, obviously we're a very divided country with regard to that. But if the court allows it, I think one of the things that's going to happen is states are going to continue to pass laws that limit the situations in which an abortion will be legal. Whether or not we're ever going to get to a point where we overturn Roe v. Wade, I don't know. But in the same kind of track, I think, is happening in this regard, with regard to sports. Now, that's only a small part. Probably there are never going to be that many male-to-female transgender athletes who are going to say, I want to compete in the Olympic Games because I couldn't cut it as a man. I want to do it as a woman. I mean, that's just not ever going to be a large number. But if it's any at all, and women who've trained their entire lives to participate in the Games get eliminated because of the man, then I think we're really going to have an explosion.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. The more I'm watching this, the more it reminds me of civil unions to gay marriage, and a lot of center right types who said, "Oh, they want civil unions."
It's camel's nose under the tent.
Yes, right. They want civil unions, and then it'll be done. And then, you know, once you start erasing lines, you never stop, and you don't get to redraw them. And I see the same thing happening here. Okay, fine. We'll draw a line at women's track and field events, or women's contact sports, and so on and so forth. But then we're going to concede all this other stuff with respect to identity politics and the benefits that are accrued to favored identities.
Yes, but if we hope that somehow or another there are going to be breakthroughs and we'll start to walk some of this back, it's going to have to be along the lines that we've just been discussing. And I think it's one thing, because track and field, although a reasonably popular sport internationally, is not terribly popular in the United States, except when we get into an Olympic year. But what about the WNBA? What's going to happen when some guy, and it's happened at lesser levels.
Yeah.
There have been men who've wanted to compete in basketball with women. But again, the NBA players are not going to stand for it.
Hmm. Well, I don't know. Well, they might not have a choice.
Well, like I said, unreason breeds unkindness, breeds unreason. But I love this description of a gentleman, the definition of a gentleman that you offer. A gentleman is not just a man who stands apart from the mob. He's a man who stands up for others, sometimes even for his enemies, often when those others have no clue that he is there for them.
Right.
I love that definition. That's very good.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
That's very good. I think that should be cut and pasted in, I don't know, a place where people can view it daily, at least men. He is Brad Miner, former literary editor for National Review, currently editor of The Catholic Thing, senior fellow of the Faith and Reason Institute, and author of The Complete Gentleman, The Modern Man's Guide to Chivalry, third edition, which releases today. So you want to pick that up. Brad, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, great pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Mike Manapkin runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay, no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out.
Do, do, do. That means it's time for our weekly hit with Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints.org, all things public policy related as it pertains to Chicago and Illinois. Ted, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
Morning. So now, are we at the foot of that COVID bridge that I keep hearing about?
To go to La La Land and Candyland?
Where are we? Where's Illinois in terms of states that are reopening, Ted?
Well, we're pretty far behind states that are reopening, but we might have our beginnings here. We're going to go on this bridge. This bridge is supposed to start, the 14th?
Yes, Friday.
And, you know, it's kind of a funny thing if you look at it. I love it, and I know, Dan, you've talked a lot about the outdoor. I love it, right? So the dining outside is going to go from 50% capacity to 60% capacity.
It's huge.
That's huge. But, the good news is we're moving that way, and I think the pressure and the move across the country is that, we're supposed to, Pritzker's mentioned June 11th as a potential full reopening. So that's good news, and I think the pressure's there, and it's going to get there. We just got to keep him honest, I guess, on that. And I think we should be excited. We're almost there, but we're going to have to suffer through this weird bridge phase.
But what does the full opening look like? Because he even said, once we cross the COVID bridge to get to La La Phase 5, masks are still going to be required.
Yeah, and I think that's the big one, right? Obviously, from everything I see is that, you know, we're going to have a pretty open economy. But the mass will still be there, and I think, you know, that's probably where the pressure will be felt. Although in Chicago and in Illinois, you know, it'll be probably downstate, you'll probably see no masks. In Chicago, you'll see masks. People start to flaunt it. You know, so it's kind of like when I was in Florida a month ago. You know, most people weren't wearing it. I think you'll get there here. We'll see what the battle looks like, because he'll want to keep imposing that. You know, and I think we need to worry about schools in the future. I think that's going to be the big one in the fall. What happens with masks?
Oh yeah.
Your colleague Mark Lennon over at Wire Points wrote about another House bill, trying to keep track of all the bad legislation circulating in Springfield. That's a big job. House Bill 3914, the Positive Action Act, passed in the House, moving in the Senate, majority, supermajorities of Democrat Socialists, both chambers, of course. It would have state agencies give hiring preferences to anybody with a protected characteristic. Generic language there that is defined as any characteristic which may be used either directly or indirectly to discriminate against or place at a disadvantage such persons having that characteristic. So now what, you get to lobby for your characteristic, your identitarian characteristic, whatever that may be. We're not talking about race or gender. Those are already protected classes. We're talking about things like, I don't know, like height or weight or attractiveness or hairstyle, or is there any limit to this?
I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up, right? And I think what makes Illinois so important for groups like Wire Points and you know, your show pushing back is that, you know, this stuff passed the House, and it's a kind of bill that could pass Illinois and become kind of a benchmark bill for other states. So it's why it's important to push back, even if people think Illinois is going way too far on the pendulum. What they're doing is they're reframing affirmative action, calling it positive action. A short guy like me will be able to say, hey, you know, I'm being discriminated against. It's not fair. I want that job. And, you know, I guess it'd be bad if it's in the NBA. But
I would say that somebody has read Harrison Bergeron, Kurt Vonnegut's classic, but I know that most of the General Assembly is illiterate. So I think they're just accidentally lurching into such a facetious dystopian world as was described as Harrison Bergeron. But the other interesting thing about this is not only can you create a benefit by organizing a class of short people, for example, Randy Newman, but you can also then impose a cost on people who are tall or strong or thin or attractive. I mean, theoretically, yeah, you could go down that road, right?
Well, I mean, think about it. In Mark's piece, there's a guy named Greg Mankiw. He's a, you know, famous economist in the U.S., and he joked about it. But, you know, they study taller, you know, taller, handsomer people make more money than a short, less attractive one. And
Dan.
And so, exactly. You know, there's multiple ways to discriminate on this. And in the end, it's like it becomes so vague, you don't even know what the hell we're talking about here. You know, how do you, when you have all these intersectionalities of different, you know, attributes, how do you measure them? And it becomes insane, really.
Ted, I wanted to ask you about House Bill 2789, which pretty much gives the power in the IDPH, Dr. Nzike, control over all schools, not just public, but, you know, private schools, religious schools, all of them. And I know that there's been some amendments to the bill, but what's the latest on it?
Well, you know, that's a big push and a lot of concern, and you're seeing lots of parents, you know, really worried about that. You know, the whole reason for sending your kids to private schools is you didn't want to be, for many, in the public school system, whether it's for, you know, the schoolwork, or whether it's for the ethics, a different, you know, different environment. And then for IDPH and the government to come in and say, we're going to control when you open and when you don't, it's ludicrous. And but that's precisely what we're kind of, you know, the kind of laws we're seeing out of Illinois. I don't know where the traction is right now, but it's out there, and there's been a huge pushback, we know. It wouldn't be surprising if those kind of things pass in Illinois.
Yeah, because I heard IDPH didn't want that extra added responsibility too, so that's part of this.
Well,
hot potato.
Yeah. Well, and you're stripping the power of our local elected boards, which right, we're having hard enough time getting control over as parents anyway. But now imagine trying to get, you know, Springfield to do something. Forget it.
Chicago State Senator Mike Simmons has proposed legislation to withhold funding from schools that apply dress codes to hairstyles. Uh-huh. said policies that ban certain hairstyles are outdated, and it would be much better for young people if there was no dress code that included hairstyles, which would have been great for me back in my day so that I could have worn the mullet that I enjoyed so much when I was in school. But this is important stuff. I mean, for given everything else that's challenging Illinois right now to get into micromanaging dress codes from Springfield.
Well, you kind of hit on my sore spot that, you know, we've got time for these kind of laws. And, you know, if we spent enough time, we could come up with lots of these kind of laws that, you know, they spend a lot of time in Springfield doing these things, but they won't talk about the things that matter, right? They won't talk about pension reform or labor laws or the budget. You know, we don't have any idea what the budget's going to look like and what's going to be in it and whether there's any kind of restraint. We don't know any of that.
But
we do know about hairstyles.
Speaking of pensions, breaking news from Crane Chicago Business, the anti-business magazine that covers Chicago rent seekers. Breaking news, Lightfoot says unfunded pension obligations are the greatest financial challenge facing the city post-pandemic. How about that? How about that revelation? Now, she's not going to do anything about it, but at least she properly identified it. So that's a start.
Well, yeah, it's a start. It's the first time she said something about them, and she's, you know, now she's passing the blame to Springfield, where it, you know, the laws do come from Springfield. They're mandates from the state house, and so she's right that it needs to change there. But, you know, my guess is, you know, she hasn't said, I want to see a pension amendment and pension reforms. What she's saying is, we need help. And what she's saying is, I want money.
I want a tax increase, and I want
I want a tax increase. Give me the money. Fight for that progressive tax increase again.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, that's exactly what she's doing is trying, you know, hey, I got my bailout money from the feds. If I get a little bit more bailout money from the state, then I can skate through 2023 in my reelection on these matters. And that's what politicians in this city and state have been doing for 50 years.
Yeah, and, you know, and they're all really good at it. They know how to do it. That's why they survived this long. You know, unfortunately, or fortunately for the reformers, the numbers, the math is stopping to work. But then here came along this $25 billion in windfall from the federal government. So all discussions of reforms are off the table right now.
How about in terms of checking status, the effort to salvage the tax credit scholarship program, which has been targeted for elimination by Jelly Belly, where does that stand?
Well, so that's, you know, the battle's on, and I've had some good discussions, but, you know, here's a big concern we have about that. So, you know, for those listeners who don't know about it, right, there's a lot of kids who are getting these scholarships through tax credits, and you know, there's a big concern in the movement that, you know, the win, people think that the win is just keeping this thing alive, no change to the program. But that'll be a big loss, because what we need is an extension. They need to extend the sunset. This program sunsets next year. So we need an extension. We need more credit. We need more kids to participate. And we need the trade unions. They want to have a big participation in this scholarship, because you know, there's other ways for kids to learn in addition to schooling. Is also, you know, learning the trades. So this program needs to grow, but if we just stay put with it and nothing happens this year, just they don't touch it, but they leave it alone, that's still a loss. We need actual expansion, you know, more time and more money to it. You know, eventually we need vouchers, right? This is just a short step to that.
The posture is right, because Pritzker wants to reduce the benefit of the tax credit benefit, and thus ultimately sort of backdoor kill the program. But the state of play in this fight this month it's happening, is to just salvage the program as it currently exists. You're just arguing that it should be more aggressive, should be promoting an extension of it.
Exactly.
Not eliminating the sunset.
Yeah, just salvaging it for what it is right now. Like, if they keep it flat, that still won't be a win, because this program dies next year if it doesn't get extended and if we don't grow it. So we can't just be satisfied with Pritzker, you know, kind of keeping the status quo. We need much more than that. That's the real win.
We talked about this a couple of weeks ago when the census data came out in Illinois losing a congressional seat this cycle. We don't know which one that'll be yet, but Then over the last couple of weeks, there has been some questions about the census counts, particularly in blue, in both blue states and states that lost as well as states that gained, suggesting that there may have been some cooking of the books, that it was surprising that New York came as close as it did to not losing any seats. It was surprising that Illinois only lost one instead of two seats. From the research work that you guys do, have you turned your attention to that at all? Have you seen or heard any evidence that calls into question the numbers that were, you know, the official numbers for Illinois in terms of the census?
Well, yeah, you know, we saw the numbers running around about how the blue states did far better than the projections, you know, over the decade, and the red states ended up doing worse than the projections over the decade. And so, you know, like anything, we ran our own numbers at WirePoint, we pretty much matched what was being said, and so I've got the numbers right in front of me. We're going to put something out on it because it's very shocking how that happened, and it's hard to find the arguments for why that happened. We understand that places like Illinois spent a lot of money to get the count higher, right? Presumably there, you know, you got a lot of people who were not counted, who might be immigrants and things like that, who are now counted. But then what's the story for the red states to go down? It doesn't make sense. And so we're going to dig into it and we'll put something out. But it does raise a lot of questions about these census numbers. It doesn't make sense.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to more scholarship on that topic from you and your colleagues at WirePoints. Ted Dabrowski, president at WirePoints.org. Ted, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Here for Zoom Learning, the Columbia Secondary School for Math and Science and Engineering, a class there, watched Amanda Fletcher, their teacher, quote, appear to suck the nipple of an unidentified topless male while she rocked her head back and forth, according to an investigative report. Following this act, Fletcher's face turned in full view of the screen and she gyrated her shoulders and smiled. This happened 12 minutes before the class in question ended. And then she resumed teaching and discussing a worksheet after that little...
performance arts?
Well, that little break. Little break.
Greg, I have a nipple. Can you nurse me?
Okay.
For Meet the Flockers.
Yeah, no, thanks for the reference.
What? I'm just letting you know.
And it was for Meet the Parents.
Or that.
$105,000 a year she makes. She's been reassigned, but not fired.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Correction on that story we told at the end of last hour about Columbia Secondary School for Math, Science, and Engineering in New York City, where you had that $105,000 a year teacher doing... Well,
performing a sex act on her boyfriend?
Yeah, sexual healing.
Oh, kind of groping? Heavy petting, Dan?
Something inappropriate for a Zoom call with her class.
Yes.
But that is a selective enrollment public school, not a private school.
Oh.
Although my suggestion that that sort of thing is tolerated at certain private schools these days as well. And thus, just because you're sending your kid to a private school or a Peyton-like selective enrollment school in New York City, you think you're immune from... the sort of chaos and cultural detritus that is present in so many government school systems. You're not. Casey Mulligan, University of Chicago economist, friend of the show, we've had him on before, put out a new study about the effects of the lockdown policies. And the top line is the lockdowns didn't work, didn't stop COVID. And, you know, it's interesting because I'm old enough to remember when they were never intended to stop COVID. The suggestion was by the pro-lockdown crowd, slow the spread.
Right. Flatten the curve, reduce hospitalizations, make sure that there's, you know, that each hospital isn't slammed.
Somewhere along the way, we got to zero COVID is the only thing that's acceptable to restore free societies to being free societies. Yeah. Here's what Professor Mulligan finds. That available data from schools, hospitals, nursing homes, food processing plants, hairstylists, and airlines show employers adopting mitigation protocols in the spring of 2020, once the outbreak became known. These were physical barriers, air filtering, distancing protocols, pods, screenings. Households were less likely to implement similar precautions. So accordingly, per capita transmission rates on site fell dramatically, usually to levels below household transmission. In one example, an hour worked in the Duke health system went from being more dangerous than an hour outside work to being more than three times safer. Overall, both the spread data and the prevalence data suggest that the prevention efforts worked, or at least that something about the organization keeps infection rates below what they are outside the organization. There was no evidence that homes became places of solitary confinement and zero transmission, which is actually putting it mildly. We know, and he confirms in his study, that that's where a majority of the transmission occurred. Infections of in-person primary and secondary students and staff were more than 20 times more likely to be traced to the community rather than to someone at their school. Something, again, we've known for a long time, but his study confirms, or at least there's been studies that have suggested that for some time now, and his study does as well. That's probably a better way to put it. But I know all of this evidence about the results of the policy paths that were chosen just doesn't matter to some people, to a lot of people, because being in lockdown has become a bit of a lifestyle. That's the topic of a piece by our next guest, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of Kent in the UK, Frank Ferrutti. He's also the author of How Fear Works, Culture of Fear in the 21st Century. That's timely. And Why Borders Matter, Why Humanity Must Relearn the Art of Drawing Borders. Most recently, Democracy Under Siege, Don't Let Them Lock It Down. Professor Ferrutti, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
So, you know, the evidence of what worked and didn't work based on what the anticipated result of a particular policy would be. I guess it's interesting for people who are interested in policy and connecting policy choices to the consequences. But that's not most people. And most people don't seem particularly interested in whether these policies worked or continue to work in order to continue joyfully living under them. And we see this in Chicago and elsewhere, too, with people wearing masks outside. They're committed to the cultural paradigm shift that COVID has brought.
Yeah, I mean, I think in that sense, the policy has worked because it has encouraged a significant minority of the public to adopt a kind of new lifestyle, a lockdown lifestyle where you, in a sense, celebrate safety as an end in itself, and where you change your behavior in such a way that you sort of no longer are prepared to shake hands, you're no longer prepared to cuddle people and embrace them, you're no longer prepared to communicate with people who are not wearing masks. You kind of adopt this very restrictive, insecure lifestyle, which has a certain amount of appeal to people. I suppose it's the logical consequence of the whole safe space movement, where you create this inverted quarantine around you, and you basically try to insulate yourself from the potential pain and the distress and the risk and uncertainties of everyday life.
You have an interesting way of framing this, too. So to summarize what you say, cardinal virtues are out and the single virtue of safety is in. You write, fear is socially dominant, not fear as an emotion, but fear as a perspective. Explain.
That's right. I mean, I think what has happened is that fear has become a perspective through which we interpret everyday events. And I think you find that if you listen to the media, if you talk to or listen to policymakers, you'll find that they approach everything from what I call a worst-case sort of approach, where they always imagine that what's going to happen is not what's likely to happen, but the worst case, and they act on the basis of everything is going to be as bad as it gets. And the biggest the most significant development of this kind of perspective is in children's lives. But kids are brought up in such a way that they're continually prevented from going outside on their own. They're continually under adult supervision. You know, the slightest pain or distress is seen as a marker for some kind of mental illness that they need to be protected from. Schools continue this, and in schools you have decided that if you criticize children, you're going to harm them. Teachers are no longer allowed in many schools to say, "You're wrong, Jimmy. You know, that was wrong, Mary," because that apparently lowers their self-esteem. And as you kind of go through life, you'll find that virtually every dimension of human experience now comes with a health warning. And that's the way it's been for some time. And now it's become even stronger under the pandemic. The pandemic just really intensified that tremendously.
Well, and there's going to be other viruses and flare-ups down the road. But what's our exit ramp? How do you see us ever getting out of this?
I think this is going to be a difficult job because whilst many of us are looking forward to freedom, total freedom, and many people are looking forward to the day when they can go to restaurants, you know, visit friends and travel freely, a lot of people have become extremely wary. And I think there's a section of our cultural elite that is continually telling us that the new normal will not be like the old normal. And what they're trying to do is to create a new normality, which is even more risk-averse than the one that existed beforehand. So I think that what we have in front of us is a very big battle where people with different attitudes towards life and towards freedom and towards how you regard the future are going to have to fight it out, because the problem is that I don't know about you, but I don't want to live in a world where I've got to wear a mask outdoors. I'm quite prepared to wear a mask now and again indoors in certain circumstances where it makes common sense. But I'm not prepared to live in a world where, for example, if I hug or shake the hand of my friend, I'm being frowned upon as being irresponsible by a section of the community. So somehow or another, we have to win the argument that we have to get used to the fact that we live in a risky world. Risk is not always a problem. Sometimes it's an opportunity. And we have to understand that at the end of the day, the human condition coexists with all kinds of threats to our well-being. And one of our biggest accomplishments has been to be able to deal with that and still survive.
Yeah, I'm not living in a world of mask wearing and waiting for Boris Johnson to tell me if I can hug somebody either.
Right.
It's absurd. It's offensive, actually. And that's something actually to be afraid of, is the fact that so many people have adopted that disposition. But I wonder if there's a subset of the COVID enthusiasts, so those that are safetyist ideologues. I get them. You're a fellow Brit, Theodore Dalrymple. I'm sure you're aware of his work. He said he wrote a piece several months ago saying part of this psychological dynamic, there's a certain subset of people who are experiencing frisson, which is the idea that there's a certain thrill they're getting in overcoming a threat that isn't really much of a threat. But they feel like this is something important that they're doing, and they'll be able to share with their progeny how they overcame the great COVID-19 virus of 2020 and 2021. And this is like an accomplishment, and they get a sense of accomplishment as well as a sense of sort of moral superiority when they tattle on their neighbor or virtue signal their, you know, their shield in front of their two masks and their, you know, hazmat suit and so on and so forth. What about that? What about the sort of the frisson subset of COVID enthusiasts, and that thrill may wear off when society opens more?
Well, I think partially it's a thrill, but I think what it is much more, it's a kind of attempt to gain status for being really virtuous and for being really heroic. And one of the points that I've been writing about quite a lot is that we live in a world where the classical virtues of courage, for example, have been demeaned, where we call, you know, so the surviving is itself an act of courage. Certainly in Europe, in the United Kingdom, for example, we use the word hero very promiscuously. So we talk about people that work in supermarkets or in the hospitals as being our heroes for fighting COVID. But all that they're doing is doing their job. And the kind of loose way that we talk about heroism, it's no longer a unique, special, you know, sort of once-in-a-lifetime deed that you've done. You know, you do heroic things routinely 10, 12 times a day just by being there. So there is a sense in which by elevating the threats and by creating this kind of drama, almost like a Disney-fied drama, you are then able to sort of put yourself in a position of being courageous, heroic, and unique. And not only that, but you, as you were implying, you can then look down upon people like myself who refuse to wear a mask when they walk outdoors. You kind of look at those people as they're as kind of lower form of human beings who, unlike you, are not aware. And they often, the word they always use that gives away these people's mental outlook is awareness. You know, sort of, I'm raising your awareness. You know, I'm aware. The implication being is that I know something. I behave in ways that you don't understand because you're a little bit too stupid to kind of grasp the complexities of the life. And I think that kind of attitude has really come out very sharply during the pandemic.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The hero thing we've certainly touched upon, that's been rendered meaningless through overuse and misapplication. But survivor, that's another addition which we really haven't touched on, but you're right. You know, so everything, you know, the as you mentioned, starting with safe spaces, you know, a speech I don't like is violence, and so I need to be protected. And then I've survived. I'm a COVID survivor. I got infected. Now I'm a COVID survivor. I'm a flu survivor. I'm a this survivor. I'm a that survivor. Everything is some sort of triumph of human will when it's something pedestrian. But I'm supposed to be elevated to the pantheon of American heroes like Audie Murphy or something, for goodness sakes, because I got sick and I recovered.
Yeah, and the irony is that when you say that, when you do that, what you actually are saying is something very different, because if you call yourself a cancer survivor, or if you call yourself, you know, a bowel syndrome survivor or a COVID survivor, what you're really saying is that your life has been determined by that event so much that you're never free of it.
Right.
That for the rest of your life, that one experience is going to mark who you are, determine who you are. And instead of, sort of understanding that as human beings, we don't want to be defined by an illness, or we don't want to be defined by a pandemic. We want to be defined by our achievements, what we've done. Instead of seeing it in that kind of a way, the whole survival, the kind of mentality, although it talks about, you know, implies outward that you're courageous, it actually betrays the idea of courage, because it basically says that you've become a prisoner of your own fate.
That's such a great insight. All right, I'm going to stop running around saying I'm an irritable bowel syndrome survivor.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, I'm going to stop doing that. Professor Frank Ferrutti, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of Kent in the UK. The books, the new one, Democracy Under Siege, Don't Let Them Lock It Down, also pick up Why Borders Matter, as well as How Fear Works, Culture of Fear in the 21st Century. Professor, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, since we were talking about virtue signaling in our conversation with Professor Frank Ferrutti, how about this? The lowest point you experienced during the pandemic, now that it's over, the lowest point.
Still in it.
Well,
I'm kidding. What's
this may give you some perspective.
Okay, let's see. The lowest point during the pandemic?
Gwyneth Paltrow. You remember her.
Oh, she's
the one who does the vagina candles?
Right, the vajayjay scented candle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We don't use that word, but mm-hmm. I guess you do. I can't.
It's biologically correct.
Okay, well, anywho, what about it? Is that her lowest point?
No. No. She admitted to drinking as many as two cocktails a night during the lockdown. She was so despondent.
Wow, two?
Wait, it gets worse.
She better go straight to Betty Ford.
She even sometimes ate bread and pasta.
Oh my God! I don't even know.
I mean, it's, boy, it really puts people like losing a loved one to the virus or something like that into perspective. I mean,
she even ate bread.
The hurt.
Pasta.
The hurt.
How could she? I got to go home.
I'll tell you what, Gwyneth Paltrow obviously went to a dark place. And today, you know, in a private moment, maybe say a little prayer for Gwyneth Paltrow and all that she experienced during the pandemic.
And those poor carbs. How dare she?
It's terrible.
Oh, my gosh.
Unspeakable.
Don't look at me. I'm hideous.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A buddy of mine just texted this photo to me, which I tweeted out.
Uh-oh.
This is a
sign. The artist?
No, it's not the former Fauci employee who turned
orgasm artist.
It's not her.
Okay. Well, you should tweet out a picture of her, too.
Sign on the drive-through window of a Burger King on Chicago's South Side. We are short-staffed. Please be patient with the crew that did show up. Nobody wants to work anymore. Now, don't tell Joe Biden that, because he lives in a la-la land where he feels compelled to tell people that if they get a good job offer, they should take it, even while discounting the notion that people are incentivized to stay home, and so that's what they're doing.
We're going to make it clear that anyone collecting unemployment who is offered a suitable job must take the job or lose their unemployment benefits. There are a few COVID-19 related exceptions, so that people aren't forced to choose between their basic safety and a paycheck. But otherwise, that's the law. I know there's been a lot of discussion since Friday's report, that people are being paid to stay home rather than go to work. Well, we don't see much evidence of that. That is a major factor. We don't see that. Look, it's easy to say the line has been, because of the generous unemployment benefits, that it's a major factor in labor shortages. Americans want to work. Americans want to work. As my dad used to say, a job's about a lot more than a paycheck. It's about your dignity, your place in the community, being able to look your kid in the eye and say everything's going to be okay. I think the people who claim Americans won't work, even if they find a good and fair opportunity, underestimate the American people. So we'll insist that the law is followed with respect to benefits, but we're not going to turn our backs on our fellow Americans.
It's the typical fork-tongued sophistry you expect from a dope like Biden.
I'm bringing up his dad again.
He feels the need. You know, we're casting low expectations on the American people. No, we're not. We're just recognizing a fundamental axiom of the human condition. People respond to incentives. If you pay me more to stay home, then a lot of people are going to stay home because they're short-sighted when it comes to paying their bills. I'll just enjoy what I have right now, making more staying home. And then when that runs out, I'll be compelled to go back to some hourly job that I can get. And hopefully the scarcity of available labor will have driven up the hourly wage by the time I decide I'm ready to go back. There's also, and I mean, again, we've heard from myriad individuals, business owners, about the challenges with finding qualified workers right now. There was also this guy who posted at the Marginal Revolution, I'm a blogger and HR analyst in the talent acquisition space. I speak to chief human resource officers and organizational executives every day. And over the past 90 days, there's been a giant disconnect between something I frequently see economists saying in the media versus what the reality of the job market is. And that disconnect is basically the Biden disconnect. I hear economists who are essentially ideologically disposed to prop up Joe Biden saying there's no evidence that people are choosing to stay home because they're being paid more to stay home, where actual employers are suggesting that's exactly what's happening.
And they're begging for people to come and work for them. Well, listen to this one real quick. Raise Higher Restaurants. This is a Chicagoan who has a message, a strong message, because they're trying to raise the wages, you know, for restaurant employees.
If your wages can't compete with $300 a week of unemployment, you might need to rethink your business model.
Right. This is the same thing that this dope Stephanie Ruhle, lots of dopes around, who apparently some NBC or MSNBC newsreader, but she has Deutsche Bank in her employment history, according to her Twitter handle. This is remarkable. Why is it that the unemployment benefits are too generous rather than the pay offered by employers too low? Pay more money equals find more workers. If margins are so thin you cannot increase pay without passing it through / losing customers, your business model doesn't work. Businesses shouldn't operate if they have thin profit margins. Well, boy, that's going to put a lot of businesses out of business. If the lockdowns weren't bad enough and the violence in big cities and not so big cities destroying businesses, that wasn't enough. Now you've got this economic pablum from the president and his media handmaidens. Remarkable. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Amity Schles, board chair of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation. Oh, for a man like Calvin Coolidge again. Winner of the Hayek Prize and best-selling author of The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression, as well as more recently, Great Society, A New History. Amity, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Glad to be with you guys.
So Biden wants to be the new FDR, and he is, but in a very negative way if you assess the two on the merits.
Well, yes. What you're talking about is incentives. Right now, there might be an incentive to postpone getting a job. In the period of the 30s, the government also created incentives. What the government did is what we're going to do next, which is push wages up really high through law, through the great labor law, the Wagner Act. And this is doing something for the worker. Think of a supercharged minimum wage, right? And what happened was the employers weren't really recovered from the Great Depression, so they couldn't afford the wages the government suggested they pay or insisted that they pay the companies. So guess what? They didn't rehire, or they rehired more slowly. And that was the tragedy of the Great Depression. It's not enough in our school books, but basically upward wage pressure caused unemployment of over 10% for a decade. That's why our parents and grandparents remember the Depression, because at 10 years of unemployment, it's a different kind of problem, but got a similar basis, which is an arrogance of government that it can, through incentives, get the economy going. Of course, they told themselves, well, higher wages, well, then people will spend. They'll buy back the car. If they work in an automaker, that will, quote unquote, get the economy going. But it didn't. Instead, what it did was lock people out of jobs. In the 30s, people did want to work, and they couldn't because employers didn't have enough jobs at the government-mandated high wage to hand out. That was a total tragedy, which is why it's ironic that the president would lean on the New Deal in that way. The only reason President Biden can lean on the New Deal is nobody remembers it.
Well, right, or they have a stylized version of the New Deal history. FDR was one of our great presidents because New Deal, and that's about the level of analysis.
Right, and in The Hill, which is a fun periodical I'm trying out, I have a column about this. It's substituting, instead of fact, you're offering nostalgia. Nostalgia is not a policy.
Right. And as you wrote in your article, you said, you know, when Roosevelt ran for office in 1932, one in four workers were unemployed. And now fast forward to 2021, one in four people make more money staying home. So if Biden wants, you know, people to get back to work and saying, you know, if you get your job, don't resist it.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for this show and your economic emphasis. I love this. The analogy that works for that, where what we're seeing now happen before, was in England. You know, today we don't use the word the dole. It's kind of a pejorative. You don't want to say he's on the dole, right? The dole was a real thing. It was the English unemployment. And the reason the word dole became a pejorative was because England discovered people didn't want to go back to work. The unemployment was just relatively too favorable. People kind of stayed home. Jobs were very tough in England at that time. I mean, working in heavy industry in the 1920s was no joke, right? You could lose a hand if you went to work with a big machine. So people tend to want to stay home too much. And even in it was an infamous story. English people stayed home in the 20s, so infamous that Roosevelt himself, President Biden's model, said, oh, we don't want any dole in the United States, never. The experiment was observed. The result was marked down in the notebook, and we didn't want to repeat it. That's a very good example. And, of course, in my own book, The Great Society, Dan, Amy, I wrote that book a few years ago now. And I think looking back, the greatest error of Johnson's Great Society, Johnson is another Biden model, is that it didn't emphasize return to work, really. It emphasized more of a payment and welfare culture, and it institutionalized, cemented that culture. And we're seeing the consequences of that today, too. Entitlements were hardened into law, even by the Supreme Court in the 60s. They existed before, but they were hardened into law. The idea that an entitlement is property in a case, for example, called, I think it's Goldberg v. Kelly, you might be entitled to your entitlement the way someone's entitled to his patent. You know, that comes out of the Great Society period.
Hardened into law in the Great Society, hardened into culture now. And you heard that in Joe Biden's message. I mean, you know, he's got to respond to Friday's jobs numbers. And so he responds by saying, hey, you know, get back to work, sort of, you know, flippantly. Hey, you know, you get a good job, then of course you want to take that good job because you're a good American. But hey, if you're afraid or if you're this or if you're that, all of the qualifications, then of course we're not going to force you to do something you don't want to do because, you know, your first order priority, as we were discussing earlier in the hour with Professor Frank Ferrutti, your first order priority is your entitlement, your human right to be safe.
And we know what comes next, right? 20-30% increase in wages, because that's what will draw them. And guess what? A lot of employers can't afford that. So you get a kind of soggy economy. I'm quite concerned about a repeat of the 70s. Oh, there's no inflation, but wages are up 30%, or lumber's up 250%, or but kind of inflation denial is part of it, don't you think, guys?
No question.
Especially if you've been to the grocery store. I mean, every week it gets worse and worse and worse.
It's interesting. I don't know if you followed it, but there's a big fight going on among economists, because even some of the economists associated with the Democratic Party, thinking here of Larry Summers, who is Treasury Secretary, know too well what happens when you create this much money, and they're embarrassed. So you sort of see Summers agonistes, right? They want to be loyal to the Democratic Party, speaking generally, but they don't want to be caught out being allowing too much inflation to happen. So they're in agony. You can see it in the public statements. Of course, there will be and is inflation. There always is when you create money to this extent, and it will be larger than we imagine. You know, when you say that, you get penalized, hit on the head by Democratic Party economists, basically. But we know it's the truth. So there it is.
Well, yeah, you can't obviously print that much funny money and not have inflationary pressure. Now, Scott Shalady, Fox Business, we talked to on Friday. He makes the point, too, that part of this is everything is happening at the same time because of the nature of this. This isn't, you know, a business cycle. This is, you're shut down, now you're open. So everybody's trying to do everything at the same time. And that is in part explanatory. It doesn't necessarily portend what will ultimately happen over time as we try to unwind from all this, particularly with sort of Jay Powell's, I think, rather reckless disposition when it comes to this profligate monetary policy and holding rates zero for another, I don't know, 2.5-3 years. At least that's what he's suggesting. But that's part of it, too. I mean, we're in such a unique place that's different than any other time in history because of the self-imposed shutdown and then sort of reopening, uneven reopening state by state.
But, you know, the overarching lesson, it's surprising to me that President Biden would lean on the New Deal in that way and lean on job creation through government in that way, because another aspect of the New Deal is there was job creation through government, and there were all these cool synergies, just as now we're going to have a Green New Deal. Well, Roosevelt had that, the reforestation plan, which sounds lovely. Some of our great-grandparents, grandparents, and so on worked in it, you know, chopping wood in the woods. That was better than no job, except it wasn't a permanent job. It was just a camp job for 3 months, 6 months. And it wasn't really great for the economy, because when the government creates jobs, it usually doesn't do it very efficiently. And synergy is way overrated when it comes to creating jobs. It's better to go to work for a company that makes one thing to its comparative advantage and really sells that thing, a new kind of whatever, than to have a make work job. And you hear all over Biden's speeches now, oh, isn't it cool? Preserving, you know, I'm stopping global warming and creating jobs, synergy. That sounds very attractive politically, but economically it makes less sense. It's suboptimal, to be polite.
She is Amity Schles, board chair of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation, winner of the Hayek Prize and bestselling author of both The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression, and Great Society, A New History. Amity, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure to be on the most sophisticated show.
Thank you so much. All right, we cut and print that. We got to print that. All right.
Be part of a tease. Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.